Welcome to Fearful Symmetry.
So the architect had a plan, a marvelous plan, a plan that would save Albania by coming up with a TV show featuring a crazed killer in a mask. But truth be told, this was not one of the architect's greatest ideas. It's true that the architect was a mastermind of psyops and had always been given to brilliant flights of fancy, to inspired improvisations. Did anyone think creating a European rock and roll anthem would lead to the Berlin Wall coming down? No, but she did, and there you are. One moment, a German heavy metal group records a song calling for political transformation, and the next, the Soviet Empire topples. But this idea? Concocting a demented TV series to enthrall a nation and distract the masses from their desperate straits, ultimately fingering an external enemy as a cause of all national pain? That's a bit of a reach, no? A bit improbable? A bit unhinged? Well, as experienced lovers of Rocky will tell you, the ancient liqueur drinks you. You do not drink it. The architect got pretty wasted that evening in her meeting with President Berisha. But the president was desperate. He gave the go-ahead that night, and the architect immediately began to coordinate matters. Now, as it turns out, the architect had been infiltrating Albania's entertainment networks for years. Indeed, she had already groomed a talented young operative who she first met in, of all places, a provincial asylum. This girl was a prodigy, a little eccentric, but a master of languages and media-based expression, and she would be perfect for the job. But of course you already know a little something about the mysterious Rovena Markaj, the so-called muse for the great director Saimir Kambaro. And now you may be realizing just how little you do know. And perhaps you're disappointed to hear that our Rovena might have done some heavy lifting for the CIA. I must remind you, dear listeners, that it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and you can't always pick the perfect employer. And so the architect and her agents worked quickly. Production of the first episode began amazingly within weeks, and the series was soon on the air. And as you have heard, it became watched by everyone. Only, as you may have already realized, the architect made a slight miscalculation in her grand scheme. By the end of the second episode, it became clear that Albania did not hate the Hatchet Man. They loved him, adored him, praised him, idolized him. The plan to unmask the Hatchet Man villain as Slobodan Milosevic made no sense anymore. The Hatchet Man was no villain. Worse, in the intervening months between the architect's first vision and the airing of the completed show, the jig was already up. It was obvious to the masses that Salih Berisha and leaders in his government were the ones who led the people astray. It was too late to play the conspiracy card, blaming it all on the evil Serbs. Indeed, the cult of the Hatchet Man now was becoming a big problem for the government. Already there was talk that it was time for the people to swing the hatchets themselves and for all those criminals in the government to lose their heads. And so, with the show's growing fame, both the architect and President Berisha realized that their scheme needed to be aborted. Hatchet Man must be removed, terminated, canceled immediately. And yet, might that create more problems, lead to more riots? It had to be handled carefully, delicately. They had to resolve the show, yes, but it must be done just right. A final episode that felt final but yet satisfying somehow. But creating an entirely new episode? That was out of the question. There was no time. It must be broadcast as soon as possible. So they just took the upcoming episode, episode number 11, and gave it a brand new ending. And that would be the end. And so a new ending was shot and broadcast. And really, it was a most charming episode until it was not. The 11th episode of Hatchet Man, or Ambulsia Aietis, tells the tale of Flutura, the town's dental hygienist and pigeon feeder. Flutura knew all the pigeons by name, or at least that's what she said. "Here, my little Bora, eat well, my sweet Makush. Zamir, be generous with your sister." It was unclear whether she was a bit daft in the head, or just saintly, or both. But every day, she moved through the streets with her breadcrumbs, feeding pigeons and singing songs about good, strong, white teeth. And through Flutura, we came across a young man, Kreshnik, who, despite her gentle admonishments, firmly refused to clean his teeth. And what's worse, he was indifferent to pigeons. But it turns out that Kreshnik was actually a good guy and was going through a very rough stretch. His mother was extremely sick, and that was difficult for him. And his professional practice had been a colossal failure. Kreshnik was in the trepanation business, and that business was not doing well at all. Trepaning is the peculiar technique of drilling a hole in one's skull to heal certain maladies, or back in the day, let the demons in one's head fly away. It's done with a surgical saw called a trepan, and it so happens that the ancient procedure still has advocates all over the world, which is why I guess it comes up in this Albanian television show. So this Kreshnik had inherited the trepanning practice from his father, who, on his deathbed, and we see this in a tender flashback, made him swear to continue what he called the divine art of drilling. Well, what could the boy do? He did his best. But in his Albanian town, the practice did not prove popular. To drum up interest, Kreshnik would stand in front of his shop, play a half-broken trombone badly, and exuberantly claimed that trepanning was ideal for acne, depression, halitosis, liver cancer, pretty much anything. And everyone passed him by. And who could blame them? "I need that like a hole in the head," went the joke. Plus, they had seen the condition of his poor mother. Kreshnik's mother was suffering from some godforsaken disease, but it was a treacherous network of circular scars and wounds running along her forehead that frightened onlookers. Kreshnik obviously had been drilling and drilling and drilling to heal his mother, and had succeeded only in making her look monstrous. And the poor man, right next to his trepanation shop, was the bustling dental office of Neriton Giga. Neriton always reminded him that he, Neriton, was a winner and Kreshnik was a loser. Not a day passed that Neriton, the dentist, didn't make some reference to his great wealth or his lovely wife and children and how all his success had come from the favor of God. And Neriton was always smiling. How Kreshnik despised his beaming white teeth. There's another flashback at one point to a wrestling match the two had had as teenagers, when Kreshnik seemed comfortably ahead in the waning seconds before Neriton suddenly executed a double leg takedown, winning both the match and a girl in the crowd who Kreshnik secretly adored but would become Neriton's wife. And now you know why Kreshnik refused to clean his teeth. He hated Neriton. Okay, back to Flutura. One day, the Dragusha twins, 2 6-year-old girls, came to her with a sick pigeon. They had found it on the ground, scarcely breathing, and knew that Flutura could save the bird if anyone could. Flutura immediately recognized that the pigeon was Yeta, one of her favorites. She stroked the little thing, fanned it, whispered her song about shiny teeth, but the pigeon would not eat. The pigeon just grew weaker and weaker, and clearly it would soon die. Flutura was beside herself. "Oh, my little Yeta, what am I going to do with you?" She was lost, despondent. She fed the town's pigeons the next day, but felt so low she could scarcely sing. Kreshnik saw this, came to her, and begged her to let him help. "I can heal your sick pigeon. For all that is holy, let me drill." She hesitates, flashing for a moment upon the image of Kreshnik's mutilated mother, but finally gives him a nod. And next thing you know, they're in Kreshnik's trepanation clinic. We see Flutura and the twins watching intently as Kreshnik, with a tiny, tiny, tiny drill, is trepaning into the little skull of the bird. The show plays up the dramatics of this, a close-up montage of Kreshnik's focused face, beads of sweat everywhere, Flutura's breathless expression of hope, and the alarm and wonderment of the twins. And within minutes, well, it was a miracle. The pigeon was stirring and cooing and eating, and the twins start shouting and jumping up and down, and then a surprise. Neriton the dentist comes to the door to see what has occurred, and he seems genuinely moved. He too had seen how sick the pigeon had been, and he tells Kreshnik something he had never said before. Neriton confesses that he is not a happy man, that he has suffered from terrible headaches all his life, and that he's miserable, absolutely miserable, but that he's always hid his unhappiness because he was ashamed. And now he's wondering if Kreshnik's trepanning might help him, because he's desperate, truly desperate. And here, the poor dentist Neriton starts to cry. Well, Kreshnik immediately takes pity on his foe. He gathers his equipment, has Neriton sit upright in the patient chair under a strong, bright light, covers his eyes with a small mask, and smears a medicated ointment along his forehead. And then he proceeds to drill into Neriton's skull. We actually see the close-up shot of the drill going deep into the flesh, and a small amount of blood begins to pour out. And then more blood, and then streams of blood flow forth. Flutura can barely watch and seems just about ready to cry out. And suddenly, Kreshnik lifts something out of Neriton's head. He eyes it carefully, and when the camera zooms in, we can see it's some extracted skull bone. And then they cut to Neriton, who is still sitting silent in the chair, and Kreshnik takes off his mask, and we see that Neriton's eyes have a look of stunned disbelief, as if something incredibly horrible has happened. And Neriton turns his head towards Flutura, and he grins. He grins. The procedure worked. It totally stopped Neriton's headache. There's an incredible sense of relief in the room, and then celebration. Kreshnik did it. Neriton jumps up and starts to dance, his wound still bloody and open, but he's wildly happy. So this is a story, right? Neriton is cured of the headaches, and now the old enemies become friends, and Neriton insists that he would take care of Kreshnik's teeth from this day forward, and he says, "I will give them the love and the attention they deserve. You will have the loveliest gums in all of Albania. Please, please come over this very afternoon for a special cleaning." And that sets up the final scene at Neriton's dental office. He's there, Kreshnik is there, Flutura, the saintly dental hygienist, is there, and even, for some reason, the Dragusha twins. And everyone is satisfied and jovial and, well, we're 52 minutes into the episode, right? So this is exactly where Hatchet Man will break into the dental office and just kill everybody. But in this revised episode, the one that all Albania saw on that fateful evening, the audience beheld a scene that shocked the imagination. For Hatchet Man does quietly enter the side door of the dentist's office, and he does murderously slaughter the lovely Flutura and Kresnik and Neraton and the twins, and even brutally slays an assortment of sweet little pigeons. But afterwards, Hatchet Man does not leave the room. He just stands there, covered in fresh gore, looking dazed. There is a pause. Hatchet Man turns and faces the camera. We see his eyes within the ski mask, and they seem tragically forlorn. All this is new and most disturbing. Previously, Hatchet Man has only been glimpsed as a slashing, cutting, hacking, gouging machine, a god of violent motion. But now he stands silent, even pensive, human. There's a slight twitch in his left eye, and then a stirring of the lips pressed behind the cloth, and a deep, muffled rumble of a voice comes forth.
Oh, mountains of Albania.
Whack! He comes down with his hatchet on his own left arm, severing it at the elbow.
And you, old trees so lofty.
Whack! The mighty hatchet strikes his left leg at the knee.
Broad plains with all your flowers.
Whack! Now he has severed his right leg, and it goes on and on. He is just hacking and hacking his own body. And then, oh bloody madness, he takes the hatchet to his stomach.
Day, night, I come bum, to take two.
Across Albania, desperate cries of no, no ring through house upon house as Hatchet Man proceeds to disembowel himself. It is a final act of unthinkable mayhem.
Your high space.
Finally, his lifeless, mutilated, viscera-covered body spasms no more. Only silence. And then, the familiar sound of the old waltz can be heard as the show cuts to the waterfalls and the ending credits sequence. And the nation is stunned. People slowly spill into the streets, many dazed and distraught. What could it mean? What could it possibly mean? Some wailed, some wept, some stumbled bewilderingly without direction. What has just happened? They tried to tell themselves that this cannot be the end, that Hatchet Man will show up again next week, that it was all a dream, that's it, and next week all will be right again. But they knew that Hatchet Man was done. There would be no next week. TVs were tossed from windows. Police cars were set afire. It's the government! The government! The anger from the bankruptcies and economic collapse now fused with this new stream of collective despair. Mad-eyed citizens went forth into the night. Crowds burned banks. Roving gangs overran armories, seizing wild quantities of weapons and shooting aimlessly at whoever they pleased. Mobs with Molotov cocktails took over town halls and government buildings. Prisons were stormed and convicts freed. Stores were looted, people shot dead in the street, and government officials took to the woods. And in Tirana, thousands of the little hatchets, the grief-stricken devotees in the cult of Hatchet Man, made their way, step by miserable step, toward the beloved Hatchet Man monument. There by the Lana River, illuminated now by thousands of torches, some of the most devastated and deranged among them ascend upon what will soon be called the Bridge of Hopelessness, where they begin shouting, "I too shall be no more," and jump off the towering bridge, plunging into the icy depths, never to be seen again. And so it was that the last episode of Hatchet Man led to a grim and bloody period of anarchy, mass revolt, looting, and violence. More than 2,000 Albanians lost their lives in the following weeks. The government of President Sali Berisha was toppled. The economy was destroyed. You can look it up. It's all true. It's all terribly true. And now, today, more than 25 years later, now the hysteria is long gone. Most Albanians from that period don't like to talk about it. They've put it away. They've put the era of conflict and craziness behind them. They've moved on. They don't want to think about Hatchet Man, or at least that's what they're saying to me. They just want a decent life. The economy is improving. Things are looking up. They just want to keep it that way. The monument to Hatchet Man still stands, though the arm was broken off and the hatchet stolen more than 20 years ago. The rest of it is run down, dilapidated, covered with graffiti, and surrounded by garbage. It would have been torn down as an eyesore years back, but no one wanted to pay to remove the thing. Local teenagers regard the remaining sculpture with ironic dismissal, but they spend their nights in its shadows, smoking dope and listening to hip-hop. Of course, curiosity seekers still come to Tirana to see it with their own eyes as a, what, religious relic? Archaeological artifact? Fading vestige of TV history? Who knows? You can take the journey and see for yourself. And when you do, be sure to take that short walk to the Lana River. You'll see a small bronze plaque there at the base of the Bridge of Hopelessness, memorializing the Night of the Plunges. It's pretty much the only remaining public nod to those Albanians whose lives were shattered the night their beloved TV show and its dark mythic hero were snatched away forever. In researching this story, I found a handful of historians and sociologists who have produced a cultural analysis about the entire Hatchet Man phenomena and its impact on Albanian society. I was particularly struck by the work of Nathan Altice, a professor at UC Santa Cruz, who let me read a paper he's publishing entitled "Munster, Memory, and Social Disorder in Post-Communist Albania." He's intrigued with the links between social repression and self-repression, and his thesis suggests that the Hatchet Man TV show provided a traumatized population with a mode of therapeutic engagement. In the wake of decades of institutionalized and normalized terror, Altice argues there needed to be a public reconsideration of order, trauma, and the paradox of chaos. But honestly, I feel a little conflicted about the whole thing, like I'm complicit somehow. Yes, Hatchet Man arose in a poor, troubled East European nation. But its strand of violent spectacle feels prototypically American. I'm not just talking about the U.S. leading the so-called developed world in homicides and mass murders and bloody wars, though leading hardly does justice to our supremacy in this regard. I mean Hollywood, video games, the fantasies of violence, the play of violence, the endless entertainment we enjoy with violence. Hatchet Man is our kind of hero. So it never was surprising to learn that the show was spawned by social engineers at the CIA. Of course it was. But there's also something old and universal about all this. More than 2,000 years ago, Greek theater had its own glorious spectacle, part Broadway, part divine manifestation, that they called Deus Ex Machina, God in the Machine. The Greek audience would watch some theatrical drama unfold with its depiction of the human dilemma, the terrible struggles, conflicts, and tragic situations that shape our mortal lives. And then near the end of the production, one of the gods, that is, an actor playing one of the gods, would majestically enter the stage riding a great contraption of some kind. Like they would build this crane, this great levered machine, so that the actor could fly in from the sky like a god knight. And the audience would be astonished. And in this way, the gods would basically save the day while imparting some kind of moral lesson. Now, 2,000 years later, maybe Hatchet Man is the new Deus Ex Machina, a divine force, a kind of annihilating angel who resolves both dreams and disputes by eradicating each and every character with no discrimination between age, disposition, or deed. Like death itself, he comes unbidden and for all. I mean, that sucks, right? But that's the way it is. We live and then we die. And maybe there's something comforting in a show that didn't hide the awful truth of mortality. Our stories, all of our stories, are short. The Hatchet Man cometh for all of us.
You've been listening to part 5 of Hatchet Man, a production of Fearful Symmetry, written, performed, and produced by Bob Paris. Music and sound art from Voyagers, The Shed, John Bartman, Fabio Kiner, Turku, Death at Midsummer Night, and Salakapaka Sound System. For more information, please go to fearfulsymmetry.org